Hi, I'm Jay Donsigani, founder and editor of All Over Cricket and host of the All Over Cricket podcast. For episode 6, I'm joined by Audrin Flynn, who writes about Irish cricket for Cricket Europe and has more than 10 years of experience covering the sport. We dissect Ireland's disappointing Super League campaign thus far, along with a wider discussion of why Irish cricket is currently at a crossroads. You can follow Audrin on Twitter at AudrinFly, and for more global cricket content, you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook at All Over Cric. Welcome to the All Over Cricket podcast. We've got a really special guest with us today, Audrin Flynn. Audrin, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Can you just tell us a little bit about your history of watching cricket, but also covering it for places such as Cricket Europe?
No problem, Jay. I actually have been watching Ireland cricket for my first Ireland match when I was a schoolboy. It was 1961 when Australia, led by Richie Benaud, played Ireland in Belfast a long, long time ago. And I've been involved in cricket for many, many years. I was president of the Phoenix Cricket Club in Dublin, which is the oldest sports club in Ireland, any sport. It was formed in 1830. It's also, I'm told, the fifth oldest continuous cricket club in the world.
You know, Audrin, it's interesting because when Barry Chambers, you know, recommended you for this podcast, he mentioned you were great with all the historical stuff and the statistics and
were like
Irish cricket.
But yeah, no. I like doing the analysis. I write match reports, but I'm not as keen on my match reports as doing the analysis. That's the truth of it. So I've been involved in cricket for over 50 years. I say I've played it. So I've been president of clubs, and I've been writing about it, and I enjoy writing about it. And I've been overseas with Ireland quite a number of occasions, you know, covering Ireland. I mean, there's a relatively small media pool in Irish cricket because Irish cricket is, it's still a minority sport in many ways. There are probably about, if I'm going to get this wrong, there's something in the order of but just over 100 clubs, maybe 120. And about half of them, most of those are, but a considerable number of those have just come about in the last maybe 10 years. And a significant number of those clubs are only because so many Asian people are now living in Ireland and form cricket clubs. There's a club in Dublin called Adamstown, which started off as a one team and has developed. And I think they now have maybe 12 or 13 teams. And every single player is Asian of all the teams, bar one.
Wow. It's interesting you mentioned that. At the end of the day, racial diversity is great, right? Mm-hmm. And you have people from a lot of ethnicities in the Irish team. I guess one issue is that perhaps there seems to be a growing reliance on especially South African-born and overseas-born players, you know, qualifying for Ireland or not qualifying for Ireland in the case of Luke Georgeson, who's got a contract with Wellington. You know, what are your thoughts with that? You know, how do you get this next generation of Irish talent, Irish-born talent, into the team?
Well, you have to put it in historical context. When Ireland made the breakthrough in world cricket back in 2007 World Cup in the West Indies, when they obviously beat Pakistan and then beat Bangladesh in the Super 8, you know, the Irish team then were all but four were club cricketers. That's all. There was no interprovincial tournament as there is now. And there was no Ireland A team like the Wolves. There was none of that. So there was four players, Trent Johnson, Dave Langford-Smith, Andre Botha and Jeremy Bray, three of them Australian, one South African. And they were a key part of that team because they brought a lot of professionalism to the team, you know, as again with club cricketers. So there always has been some sort of reliance on overseas, the people who are from other countries outside of Ireland. But all of those four players came to Ireland as club cricketers originally, club professionals. Each at that stage, every club, certainly in Leinster, I'm not sure Ulster, I'm not too sure about that. But certainly in Leinster, each club was allowed to have one professional playing in the leagues. And they were all professionals playing in the leagues. Instead of going back after 1 year or 2 years, returning home, they all married Irish girls, Irish women, and they got Irish citizenship and obviously played for Ireland. Nowadays, as soon as you mentioned a lot of South Africans now in the Irish setup, particularly in the interprovincials, there's always been a connection, particularly in Northern Ireland, with South Africans. It happens in the rugby team as well. The Ulster rugby team have a lot of South Africans playing in it, have had for many years, because there is a connection between South Africa and Northern Ireland. But if you look at the current team, the team that, for example, played last month against the Netherlands, virtually all of the team were actually Irish born. You know, it was only a handful. And it is a debate that is ongoing at the moment, is whether or not we should be recruiting. We have no issue really recruiting top-class players who want to play for Ireland. You know, that's fair enough. Most countries do it. India don't have to do it, obviously. But a lot of, well, they don't. I mean, they have about 20 teams you could put out. But Ireland, sort of, we're not going to turn away top-class players. One of the difficulties is that many of the players who are playing in cricket here and playing in the interprovincials, it's arguable whether or not they're any better than the players, Indigenous players. You know, a lot of them are decent players, but, you know, are they any better? Or are they being, you know, some of them are, some of them not so much. I mean, interesting. I mean, the best of them probably this season, you mentioned a few minutes ago, Luke Georgeson. Well, he'd come over, he's got an Irish passport.
Yeah.
He could play for Ireland tomorrow, I think. In fact, my understanding is that he was asked to play in the series next week against South Africa. But he said no, because he has a Wellington contract. And therefore he wants to keep his options open. And I suppose he wants to give himself a chance to see if he could break through to the New Zealand side, which is fair enough, ambition to have, you know. And he will probably give himself a year or two to see if that's possible. Can he do it? If he can't, he may well return here and look to play for Ireland. I don't know. I mean, PJ Moore, for example, is back here again. He was here for a number of years. He was here, in fact, yes, and declared his ambition to play for Ireland back about 5 or 6 years ago, maybe more actually this day. And then he was called up by Zimbabwe and he went off to Zimbabwe, and obviously then he could no longer qualify without going through the requalification period, which he's now going to do. I think it's 2 years' time before he's eligible to play for Ireland again. But the question is he any better than Neil Rock? Is he any better than Lorcan Tucker? Is he any better than Stephen Donohue? The jury is obviously out on that. The biggest problem we have now, and this relates back to the Netherlands and what happened there, is Irish cricket's at a major crossroads now. We're still winning the odd game against the better teams. I mean, we beat England, obviously, last July. We beat the West Indies and Afghanistan last year in T20 matches. We should have beat the West Indies in an ODI out there, but we literally threw it away in the last over when we missed two clear runouts in the last over, which would have won the game. But back since Phil Simms left 2015, it has been going downhill, no question. The standard has fallen. The level and form of new players coming through is very patchy as of yet. I mean, the best of them at the moment, of the newer players, are probably Mark Adair, who is an all-rounder, although he hasn't really delivered that much with the bat yet, but he is capable of doing it. But his bowling has been exceptional. But then he injured himself last year in West Indies, did his knee, and had to get surgery in that. He's only back this year. But the evidence from the last few weeks is that he has coming back to his best. So although he couldn't break into the team for the Dutch. Harry Tector is one of the newer players coming through on the batting side. Now, Harry's a very good batsman.
Yep.
A lot of talent. But he has to start scoring runs. He got a 50 in the last match in the Netherlands, which is his first 50. He continuously was getting into the 20s and 30s and then getting out. He has to learn as a number four batsman, you can't do that. You know, especially, you know, as when you've got a team that is so heavily reliant on Paul Sterling and Andrew Balbirnie, because outside of that, we are struggling. If they get out early, if one or both get out early, we struggle, and that's the truth. Of, you know, and we struggle against the Netherlands, and the Netherlands are a decent team, but without sounding arrogant about it, because Ireland obviously in this position, they are an associate team, and you know, in theory, don't have the resources that Ireland should have. They're not a full member, obviously. Although, oddly enough, they're in the position Ireland were in about 7 or 8 years ago, because Irish players, as you know, are not allowed to play in the county championship anymore without relinquishing the opportunity to play for Ireland. And they now have about half a dozen players playing. The Netherlands have half a dozen players playing in county cricket, and you can see it. And remember, Ireland lost 2-1. But the Netherlands were without their entire middle order. Yep. They didn't have Tendai Scada. They didn't have Robert van der Meer. They didn't have Acheson from Leicester.
Ackerman.
Colin Acheson. Ackerman, sorry. Yeah. Colin Ackerman. They didn't have any of those. And their batting was their problem. And yet they still won 2-1. You know, because we could not cope with it. And we're losing our opening batting has been a disaster for some time. Yeah. We really have. We don't. I mean, we have Sterling, and we've had, I did a piece there recently, about a month ago, in the aftermath of the Dutch match. And I think he's had nine opening partners in the last 2 years, and none of them have really done anything.
Yeah.
I think it's a poor sign when William Porterfield is now back opening for Ireland. I think it's a very poor sign. He's in the squad. At one level, I'm surprised he is. At another level, I'm not surprised, because he failed against the Netherlands. And he failed against Netherlands A.
Yeah.
Against the Dutch A in Oak Hill in June. I think it was June, early June, yeah. He wants to continue to play for Ireland. That's fair enough. He's entitled to do that. I compare him to Kevin O'Brien, who was obviously out for a duck in his last innings. Gavin decided that ODI cricket is no longer up to that level, and he's stepped away from it. I am disappointed that there is, in the squad, there is no other recognised opener other than Porterfield alongside Sterling.
You're right about that. There is no. I'm actually very glad you touched upon that. It leads me to, you know, two questions I wanted to ask you. Obviously, the over-reliance on Balbirnie and Sterling. But, I mean, I think firstly, focusing on the ODI squad, like you said, there is no backup for William Porterfield. And I hope this doesn't sound harsh, but in the perhaps likely event that he doesn't come off yet again, he's actually averaging 19, just a shade over 19, since the retirement of Ed Joyce.
That's right.
4th May.
That's right. You know, I have written pieces about William. I have a lot of time for him. I think he's done a great job for Irish cricket over many years. But I think there's a time when you recognise that your time is up. To stay on now, I put it like this: he has to score runs. If he doesn't score runs in the next week or 10 days, whatever length of time it is, starts on Sunday. Yeah, in next couple of weeks, if he doesn't score runs, it just doesn't raise a question mark about him. It raises a question mark over the selectors and the coach.
Yeah.
That they continue with him, even though he failed miserably in the last 5 representative games he's played. You know, and, you don't want him to end up with the sense that he's just hanging on for the sake of it. He wants to keep on playing for this, for him, for selfish reasons. You know, you could argue the other side of the coin and say, well, who else is there? I mean, who should be in there? If he's not going to be there, who should be in there? Well, my own belief is that you're better off putting in a younger player, let him get the experience at the highest level, and see how they go, he goes and they go. And because, as you say, I find it difficult to believe that the Porterfield is going to make many runs. He may prove me wrong. But they mean the South African attack is significantly more than the Dutch. Never mind the runs he got in the interpros. You know, the attacks the attack he's going to be facing next week. I was watching some of the T20I matches there, West Indies and South Africa, the last few evenings on and off. Oddly enough, when Nakia and Rubada and Okea all will pose a major threat running down the hill of Malahide at bowling up to 90 miles an hour, Shamsi could be an even bigger threat to Ireland. Ireland do not play spin well at all. Just don't do it. And it's a remarkable, again, I've written about this and I've complained about this, what is going on? Ireland still haven't got a spin coach, either for bowling. We don't have a bowling spin coach. Never had one. You know, the bowling coach who is a medium-paced bowler, that's what he was himself. Now, it doesn't mean to say he's not capable of doing it. But at this level, you need specialised coaches and a specialised spin coach, and particularly against wrist spinners. He really struggled. I mean, I was watching talented West Indian batsmen the last few nights trying to play Shamsi, and they hadn't a clue. They had no idea which way the ball was going. You know, they were lucky it was only a four over. He could only bowl four overs. You know, if you had to be able to bowl in 10, they wouldn't have got 100, you know. So, I mean, that's the problem that exists. We don't have, in the squad, I would put somebody like James McCollum. Now, James McCollum has had a few opportunities.
Yeah, like you were saying, I mean, it's interesting you mentioned James McCollum, because fun fact, he's the only person since the retirement of Ed Joyce, the only opener other than Paul Sterling to cross 50 for
Ireland. He did it against Zimbabwe. He did it in his first series against Zimbabwe in Belfast. I thought he was treated quite badly when Ireland played Afghanistan in a test match back in, 2019, early 2019, in, I think it was Greater Noida. And James McCollum made his ODI debut in that, right? In one of the, there was three ODIs, or four ODIs in a test match. And he got a first ball duck, right? Then he was dropped the rest of the series, which I thought was a bit harsh. There are a lot of more experienced players who seem to get a free run at it no matter what they do. And that's one of the problems. We're still relying on, I know, okay, it's now fading out. Porterfield is now the last man standing from the 2017, last man standing, with Kevin O'Brien gone from that. But Kevin still obviously intends to play T20Is, and he intends to play test matches if we ever play another one. but who knows whether they do or not. He certainly, at the minimum, it's going to be 4 years between home tests, at the minimum, 4 years, because we won't have one this year. I don't know, we're going to have one next year. But so, I mean, go back to the squad, the Irish squad. It's now, it's a good thing Curtis Camphor is back in the squad. Now, there is a lad from South Africa who turned up. He's an Irish passport. He appeared out of the blue in February of last year. They played the Wolves and he appeared on the scene. He had mentioned to somebody that he had an Irish granny, so that they had a look on him, and he did very well. And then obviously he came in and he played against England last year and did exceptionally well. So, now, one of the interesting things which had bemused him, he didn't do too well in club cricket here, so he didn't. And I suspect that's much more to do with the quality of the wickets than the quality of him. You know, he wasn't used to playing the sort of wickets that he was playing on at the levels before, either in South Africa or obviously in Southampton, where he made runs. So he's been out for the last month with an ankle injury. But he's back in the squad. Now, he hasn't played any cricket whatsoever, but I presume he will play. Well, he won't play this week, so there's no where he's going to play. So the match, the first game is on Sunday, so imagine where he's going to play. So he is important. Now, the question is, where does he play in the team? If he comes into the team, who does he come in and place off? Because the most obvious one would be George Dockrell. Now, George Dockrell obviously has reinvented himself as a batsman.
Absolutely, yeah.
As opposed to being a prodigy left-arm spinner when he made the Ireland team when he was 17 and tied the West Indies up in knots, actually, and England up in knots in 2011 World Cup, T20 World Cup. But he seemed to lose his way with the ball, which was unfortunate. George's never was a great turner of the ball. Never was, never turned the ball much. But he had great control of flight and length. That seemed to have deserved him to some level. But the batting, his batting has come on leaps and bounds. He's unrecognizable now.
Yep.
But so, but if you bring Camphor back in, then who do you leave out? Now, there is another option, and it's an option I actually wrote about last year when the, with given the struggle with openers. He's got a very, I presume you've seen him bat, have you, Camphor? Have you seen him bat?
Absolutely, yes, yes, yes. And
he's got probably as good a technique as anybody in the R&T, batting technique. I would consider him as an opener.
Isn't that a little bit risky? Because he has shown that...
risky than Porterfield?
Well, I mean, in an ideal world, at least for me, Porterfield wouldn't be in the squad. I'd have someone like Stephen Doheny.
No.
You know?
Yeah, no, I agree with you. Yeah, Doheny. Although I think Rock will turn out to be the better of the two of them, actually, coming off myself. Just that's the only opinion.
Do you feel like maybe the selectors are giving too much weight to run scored in the Interpros?
Yeah, that's a good question because, and I've been thinking about it, and I wrote about it, again, wrote about it there last week, the week before. You see, the Interpros, the new concept of the Interpros, where all the 48 best players in the country were divided into four groups of 12, and each group was allocated to a province, with the addition, obviously, of Munster coming into it. They only ever played T20s, now they're playing the full bank, you know. Now, in reality, the Munster team is actually, there's only one player born in Munster who plays in the Munster team. And they were also very unlucky at the Munster, because there are three main names coming in, Tyrone Kane, Curtis Camphor, and Gareth Delaney, all got injured very early on and missed most of the tournament. So, you know, they were left down with what was left. They had PJ Moore, and they had that in. And they had a very talented batsman called Murray Cummins. He did exceptionally well. He is South African, I think, as well.
I believe he scored 100 on the day the squad was announced. It was either the day or the day after.
Yeah, but the problem is him. He's not qualified to play for Ireland yet.
Yeah.
And we're not sure, will he be? Because there's some issue over his visa. Well, there is. He couldn't play for a team in the north at the minute because the visa regulations are different in the north of Ireland than they are in the Republic of Ireland. So he couldn't do that. He couldn't play. He's trying to, because you have to serve the period of time, you have for the qualification period. He didn't come over down last year. Now he's claiming that COVID regulations prevented him to coming last year and therefore broke the continuity of his qualification period. That's for other people to sort that out. He's a good player, talented player, would be one of the few who would, I believe, be capable of playing for Ireland. I think he would be. He's a lot of time. He's you know, you know yourself. You can always tell a good player by the amount of time he has to play a stroke, and he has time, you know. And so, I mean, the Munster, so the point is, this new concept, in paper, it seemed ideal. The games were more competitive, although there weren't that many close games. People will tell you how competitive the games were. There actually weren't very many close games, but they were competitive as good going. But my issue is, my problem is, my concern is that, and I think the Netherlands series showed this to some extent, that maybe the standard we have at Interpro level is nothing like as high as we believe it is. And I think that is my concern. And I suspect, you know, I mean, we lost to the Netherlands. I mean, remember all of the players, all of the, unlike years previously, all of the players in the Ireland squad all play in Ireland and all play in the Interpros. That's the highest level possible to play in Ireland at the minute. Yeah, and will be for the foreseeable future, I presume. And yet, you know, if somebody's getting 5-6 wickets in a match in an Interpro game, I mean, one of the interesting things is Graham MacArthur was bowled exceptionally well in the Interpros and bowled exceptionally well for the Wolves. Yet they took him to Netherlands. I don't know if you saw any of the cricket in the Netherlands.
I saw almost all of it, yeah.
Right, okay. Well, they were fairly sporting wickets, to say the least, now. Yeah. They weren't. You wouldn't really call them top-class standard wickets. You wouldn't. I don't think you would anyway. yet McArthur didn't get a game. So you have to wonder, you know, do the selectmen themselves, given that he was the outstanding bowler, one of the two outstanding, but alongside Barry McCarthy, two outstanding bowlers in the tournament, in the pros, yet he can't get in the Iron team. So are they saying, well, okay, that's all very well and good. We have the inter-pros, but we're not going to trust what we're seeing here, and we're going to revert back to what we knew before. And then
it's
you
interesting
wonder,
you say that, because it's almost like a mixed message. I feel like if William Porterfield, you know, scores runs in the inter-pros, he gets back in. He hasn't really
He scored runs against Northern Knights. He scored runs against Munster Reds, and let's face it, the Munster Reds attack is not exactly South Africa. You know, and that's the reality. You know, so that would worry me, and I think we are sitting. You see, this I believe is something to do. Graham Ford has an affinity with William Porterfield and Gary Wilson before that. He had worked with them, coached with them in Gloucester. And he has described Porterfield as the best captain he's ever been involved with. Now, Porterfield was an excellent captain, no question about it. One of the best fielders in international cricket and a gutsy player. But his height was several years ago, and his peak was several years ago. And I think that Ford is good. And Andrew White, the chairman of selectors, who after all played with Porterfield for many, many years in the Arrington, they sort of know what they could do and are sort of hoping they can do it again. Whereas the figures and statistics say, well, not really. It doesn't look like they can anymore. You know, and I mean, let's say, the first, Porterfield gets out or next to nothing next Sunday. What are they going to do the second game and the third game? The second game, the last time, he got a second chance against the Netherlands, and then he was dropped, and then Kevin O'Brien came in, obviously got a duck, and so and he's left the scene. So, I mean, what are they going to do if Porterfield gets out cheaply the first two games? Who are they going to open with? I mean, what are they going to do then? And this is where there is a big hole in the strategy, as I see it. And the more games that we play against the better teams now, we rarely look that competitive. You know, okay, we beat England, obviously, but that was purely Balbirnie and Stirling.
Yeah.
You know, if you look at who have we beaten without at least one of those two performing, you know, it's very hard to think of any real examples where we have won games without those at least one of those two performing.
Yeah.
I mean, I know you gave me a stat there of Stirling getting 23% of all the runs this year.
Just to clarify, Paul Stirling has scored 25% of all runs off the bat for Ireland since the 25th of May, 2018. Andy Balbirnie, 18.3%. Their combined total of 43.3% is the highest for the top two batters for any country that's played, that's played as many games as Ireland since the retirement of Ed Joyce.
That's right. I did a breakdown myself there of Stirling and Balbirnie's contributions under Graham Ford and prior to that under John Bracewell. And it's becoming more and more stark.
Yep.
You know, and Stirling cannot continue to play as he's done. I mean, he's got, no matter how good any batsman is, they will run into a fallow spell, you know. And if the top order is undermined, which it will be if he gets out early, and Balbirnie has been a bit hit and miss this season now. He's getting some runs and he gets out cheaply, you know. And I think the pressure of being captain is obviously weighing on the shoulders to some extent. He feels responsible for it. But around him, you know, I mean, people were saying, oh, Dockrell did well. Yeah, he got 40 runs or something, you know, and that's okay. But he's playing Holland or the Netherlands. I mean, that's who he's playing against. I mean, you know, you would expect to be able to do that, even though they have a decent attack, and they do have a decent attack. The big test is next week. I mean, because South Africa in the World Cricket League table, Super Cricket League table, I mean, they're actually below Ireland at the moment, bizarrely enough, but then they haven't played the number of games. I think Ireland's sort of the best result for Ireland came out with Sri Lanka getting absolutely, in fact, They actually got 5 points yesterday because the game was washed out. But Sri Lanka have played the same number of games as Ireland now. They only have 5 points, I think it is, you know, or whatever, 8 points. So Ireland don't play Sri Lanka. They're not in their same, they're not one of the 8 teams they play. So we may see a situation where Ireland are sort of trying to sort of stay ahead of Sri Lanka. And if you look what is left, we've got South Africa. Then we have Zimbabwe in August here. Now, that is winnable, obviously. But they've improved. Zimbabwe have improved to some extent the last couple of years. Then next year, we have West Indies in the Caribbean, and we have New Zealand and Bangladesh here at Ireland. And that's it. Now, it's fairly sort of, most people are estimating that it'll take about 100 points to qualify for the next World Cup. Ireland have 20. So we have to get 8 wins out of the last 15 games. Realistically,
that's going to be hard. That's going to be hard.
Well, it's going to be exceptionally difficult.
Yeah. I mean,
okay, you would target Zimbabwe, but then we would have targeted the Netherlands. And that didn't work out too well. We would have targeted at least one win against Afghanistan at the start of the year. Didn't do that either.
Well, I'd argue that there were 30 points up for grabs against the Netherlands.
There were, yeah, absolutely. Well, we should have got there.
I don't think many people actually predicted a 2-1 scoreline in favor of the Netherlands. I've heard 2-1 in favor of Ireland.
I did. Yeah, I did 2-1 Ireland. Yeah, that was my prediction. I didn't think we'd lose. I was fearful, though. I tell you what I was fearful of. I was in my preview piece. I had watched the Netherlands A team against the Ireland A team. And half of the Ireland team were actually played in the Wolves team.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't do very well, including like Porterfield, for example. Porterfield got 19 runs in 3 games. You know? And then I sort of was a bit concerned. Tector played. A few others played. But I was a bit concerned. And I started in the series, the Kingsman was the best bowler, but didn't even get into the Dutch team until the third match.
Yeah.
You know, so I was concerned that they couldn't handle what they were facing very well. And then, so I had a bit of a concern, but I still think they would have won the series, and they should have done. They shouldn't have lost the first game. Should never have lost the first game. I mean, they were in a position to comfortably win it. But there's a lack of confidence in the side now, particularly outside of the two main players turning the batting side. Outside of Balbirnie and Sterling, there's very little confidence. People are sort of constantly think they're under pressure for their place in the team. And fair enough. I mean, people should be under it, but very few occasions are other batsmen standing up and saying, I'm going to get 100 today. You know, it's not happening. I mean, nobody outside, under Graham Ford's reign, so 2018, nobody outside the top three has got a century for Ireland in ODIs.
Yep.
Not one outside the top three batsmen. And that is obviously a concern, because if the top three breaks down, where's the runs coming from? You know. So as I said at the very outset, Ireland is at a crossroads. We need more players. We need more experience. But getting it is the problem. You know, okay, we have the Interpros now, and we have academy, and a lot of good work's been done in the academy. You know, you come to a point when you've got, now, Ford's been a good coach. He's very insidious. He does all the right things. Maybe you could say he's a bit blinkered about certain players, and they will continue to be picked. But I suppose all coaches and managers in different sports will do that. That's always a possibility. Although there's very few sports where the statistics are as stark as they are in cricket.
Yeah,
maybe baseball, but I don't know enough about baseball. So then you've got, I'm not suggesting getting rid of Ford. I would question the role of the batting coach who's been there for some time now, because our batting doesn't seem to have improved to any extent. And I doubt if he is having much impact on Sterling and Balbirnie, because their coaching originally came through Middlesex. So the younger players, arguably, what has been contributed. And certainly psychologically, we're missing out. We're having far too many collapses in the batting order, far, far too many. And that puts, obviously puts more pressure, heaps more pressure on for the next game and the game after. I mean, the reality is that Ireland cannot afford to finish bottom of this group.
Absolutely not.
Because then potentially they're in a playoff for to remain in the top 13 in the Super League. Do you know, and if Ireland, which spent a long time trying to become a full member, now they wouldn't lose their full membership, as I understand it, but they would lose the ODIs that the Super League brings, 24 guaranteed ones in 2 years or 3 years, whatever. And that would be humiliating. If Ireland actually were to drop out of the ODI table, that would be humiliating for everything. And it would cause a major issue in our cricket Ireland, you know. I mean, like any sport, you've got people there, but a lot of people overstay their welcome. A lot of people stay longer than they should. You know, it is sometimes important to have new voices, new faces, a new voice in the dressing room, different spin on things. You know, and I think we're close to that point now.
Absolutely. I'm glad you mentioned that, Audrin. Like you said, I feel like something's got to give. And I would say if Ireland do finish 13th, I think there is a very strong chance that they go down to League Two. Oman are looking great right now in League Two, which, by the way, is pretty competitive, especially at the top of the table.
It is.
And
I'd be more concerned about Scotland. Scotland would concern me more.
Yeah. Well,
you know, man, oddly enough, Ireland got a decent. I know they lost the T20 game to Oman in the qualifiers for the T20 World Cup. Scotland would be a more dangerous team for Ireland because we know each other so well. Scotland would not fear Ireland. They know the players, and Scotland's are very decent players themselves. I would be more concerned about playing Scotland than I would be playing Oman.
Well, I mean, Oman did defeat you in 2016 at the first round of the World
Cup. That was the T20.
Yeah.
We're not playing T20.
one thing, Audrin, I will say.
We actually play them in the World Cup pre-qualifiers. I refuse to call them the World Cup finals in October. It's a pre-qualifier. Sorry, it's another pre-qualifier. Yeah. That's all I'm concerned. You know, there's only eight teams. We have Oman, we have Papua New Guinea, and we have Sri Lanka.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Sri Lanka can't continue to be as bad as they are. You know, hopefully they will, but maybe they won't. You know, so it's important we come out of that and get into the Super 12s. So, you know, that's and we play in the UAE, and we actually were very, very, very well used to playing in the UAE. We played there many, many times. I've been over there a few times myself with the Irish playing, and we're very comfortable playing in the UAE. In fact, story for you. Eddie Burrell, who was the coach at the 2007 World Cup, Eddie Burrell, and then he stepped down and handed over to Phil Simmons. Eddie Burrell, at one point, because of the uncertainty about the Irish weather, suggested at one point that we should use the UAE as our home base to play our matches. You know, but it didn't fly very far. Wilbur and Wright flew further. But
Ireland have played a lot in Oman as well, and that's where
the last couple of years, particularly last couple of years, absolutely. 2 or 3 years, I have, yeah. We seem to have some affinity with Oman because the Ireland soccer team have seen them play Oman quite often in recent years as well. And the facilities are very good. Now, I haven't actually seen, all I've seen is a one camera stream so far from any games in Oman, you know, which is.
Yeah, that's really frustrating.
Yeah.
It was like that with the Challenge League as well. I think it was Group B with the Challenge League with Hong Kong and Jersey.
Was it? Okay. All right.
I mean, as a Hong Kong fan, it was ridiculously disappointing.
You're from Hong Kong yourself, are you?
Yep. Born and raised, man. Played in the age group setup as well. And
You played for Hong Kong, did you?
No, I did not play for Hong Kong. I wanted to. Okay.
Fair enough. Yeah,
but
so you know Trent Johnson then, do you?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if TJ's listening to this podcast, but I do some commentary for Cricket Hong Kong as well. And let's just say he's been ragging on me recently. I'm not gonna tell you why.
No, but
if you ask him about it, I'm sure he'll go on.
Trent is not shy in coming forward. He's not.
No, but
but he actually, in many ways, was like, I don't get off the tangent slightly, but Trent in particular was the man who really kickstarted the whole Irish cricket revolution.
Yep.
He would, if you let your standards fall, you knew about it. I can tell you that he really knew about it, you know, and he was tough, tough competitor, you know, and he played on until he basically his legs wouldn't go anymore. It just wouldn't work. Yeah. You know, he just couldn't run in anymore. You know,
I'll tell you one thing. About so, like when I met TJ in person, he was a lot bigger in person.
6 foot six
on TV. But
6 foot six, big guy.
Yeah. But I don't know. I think the thing is in 2007, players all across the world and teams across the world just wore like really loose clothing, and now it tends to be a lot more like tight fitted.
I was like,
"Wow, this guy is massive!" Right? You shake his hand, and his hand's like,
"Yeah, massive guy."
Yeah.
When he came first, when he came down first playing club cricket, he had played a few games for New South Wales in the Sheffield Shield. And he played club cricket here, 20 years ago. And he was genuinely quick. He was a genuinely quick, fast bowler. He really got the ball down. And we're talking about club batsmen now, and they were going, oh, hold on, what's this all about? I didn't come here on a Saturday afternoon, my day off, to get a ball whizzing past my ears, you know. And that's the way it was. And he was a tough character. And he said, if you want to be successful in Ireland, because Ireland before that, the Ireland cricket team were largely, it was sort of social cricket, not much more. Ireland would play the MCC at Lord's every other year. And basically it was a 2-day match with a lot of hospitality, you know. That's the way it worked, you know. And then it changed, and the likes of Jeff Van Johnson, Andre Botha, particularly Jeremy Bray, they changed the mentality in Irish cricket. And A.D. Burrell bought into that and came along. I mean, for 2007 World Cup, there's a guy called Jason Mullins who was the captain and the opening batsman, and they decided that he wasn't interested in getting fit enough, and suddenly he was just dropped, axed from the team, which he wasn't unhappy with, obviously, but that's how ruthless it was. And that was something that Irish cricket hadn't really sort of seen before. And we're at the point, to go full circle, I think we're close to the point where we need to get very ruthless again.
Yep.
You know, because the whole project, I mean, there's been a number of reports launched by Cricket Ireland the last few years. There was one in 2016 called Making Cricket Mainstream.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's all very good, aspirational, all of that. But the reality of making cricket mainstream in Ireland, when you've at least five other sports with bigger following, bigger interest in, you know, it's a noble ambition, but it was never practical. It was never going to happen, you know. And there was a new one issued there this year. I think it was this year. It was a few months ago, another report, which to a large extent is a rewrite of the first one. It's pretty much the same report, just different spin on it. And it is very, very difficult. I can understand, obviously, Cricket Ireland have to be positive, show a lot of positivity, make it look as if we're doing very well, and we've expanded greatly. A lot of the expansion is down to sort of quick cricket, kids cricket with plastic bats and plastic balls, you know what I mean, in terms of actual numbers. And as I said, referred to earlier, if there weren't so many Asians living in Ireland, particularly in the medical and IT, that's where most of them are, you know, and there's no guarantee they're going to stay in Ireland. Now, obviously, some of them will, but get there. But if we hadn't got the Asian cricketers, we would be struggling. Some clubs would be struggling to field teams. Now, you would hope that a breakthrough comes in number of players coming from that through that scenario over the next 2 or 3 years, because they say there's 50% roughly in Leinster playing are from Asia. Yet, we haven't really got any players coming through. Simi Singh doesn't count in that, because Simi Singh came originally and then went back home again. So Simi Singh is the only real sort of Asian player who's the Asian background who's playing for Ireland. You know, and you compare that with the Irish soccer team, who have now got about in their squads about maybe half a dozen players from Nigeria who were either born in Nigeria or came here when they were young, you know, who have made the breakthrough. We have a number of athletes, particularly sprinters, particularly women sprinters, who have made the Irish squads for the athletics, and at least one or two of them may well be in the Olympics next month, or this month even, this month. Yeah. That hasn't happened in cricket yet. And I think it needs to. Now, maybe it's as simple as they aren't of a high enough standard. I don't know. I mean, maybe, I don't know, if Simi Singh is a big enough role model for them. I don't know. But what needs to happen, cricket will continue in Ireland, irrespective, but it will not necessarily continue at the level it is now unless dramatic changes are made. And I mean dramatic, I mean, by the end, if Ireland fail, well, they won't qualify. I don't believe there's any chance of Ireland qualifying automatically for the World Cup. Don't believe
it. I agree. Yep.
If, however, we, nightmare scenario, we end up last, it's hard to see where Ireland's cricket goes from there, because sponsorship, finances, everything. I mean, we're already struggling for finances, and that's the reality. We don't play test matches because we can't afford to play test matches. Simple as that. Yet, oddly enough, that was thrown out there a few months ago by Cricket Ireland. It's a problem for the smaller nations. Yet, Zimbabwe have played six test matches in 3 months, four of them at home. Afghanistan played two test matches against Pakistan in Abu Dhabi. So suddenly, why is it Ireland's the only ones that can't afford to play test matches? I don't understand that. You know, I know Kevin O'Brien's hanging on to play test matches. I wouldn't be holding my breath, Kevin, if I should, you know. And I think that's, you know, I think we're financially, we're in difficulty. I know we sort of showed a surplus there a couple of months back. But the reality, that surplus is effectively the amount of money the Irish government gave to Cricket Ireland, as they give to a lot of other sports, because of COVID. You know, so effectively, it left Ireland without an actual big debt because the Irish government covered it. You know, I think there was also money came from Northern Ireland government as well, I think. But certainly, the public got 1.6, 1.7 million euros, something along that lines, which obviously made a massive difference. Because obviously there's no, you know. Now, as I say, what happens next, I don't know. It's hard to tell what happens next. The results will dictate, actually, what happens next. Results over the next 3 weeks, then the results against Zimbabwe in August. If we could beat Zimbabwe 3-0, then that's a big if. It gives us some leeway to at least get away from the relegation battle. I would expect Sri Lanka will recover to some extent. I believe they will. So I think you're into a battle with Zimbabwe, ourselves, possibly the Netherlands. Oddly enough, I think the Netherlands will surprise a few people along the way themselves. If all their players are back.
Yep.
If all the key players are available.
After the county championship season ends as well. You're going to see that after the World Cup as well, towards the end of the year.
Yeah, absolutely. A couple of the players, like Ken Descott, he's almost 40 now, you know, and Amanda Muir must be high 30s as well. But still, you know, so the other thing is, I mean, we've got that. We have the T20 World Cup to look forward to. And as I say, we should, on theory, if you even go by rankings, we should be actually qualified for the Super 12 or whatever it's called. We should do that. And that'll be interesting to see why they're doing that. And then there's qualification for the following year from the one that was supposed to be in Australia this year. And I'm not even sure. I was trying to find out the other day, and I couldn't figure out when the qualification for that actually was, for the following T20 World Cup. Because the one that Ireland qualified was actually the other one. But they're using that qualification for this one now. Because this was the Australian qualification one that we qualified for. And bear in mind as well, you're talking about ability and how we're doing. We only came third in the qualifying tournament in UAE.
Yeah, I believe you lost to PNG, right? Was it? It was PNG.
We lost to Oman.
Okay.
We lost to PNG.
It was PNG, I believe, right? It was either PNG.
Hold on, I think we lost to Netherlands. Oh, Netherlands.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The Netherlands.
Netherlands beat us. No, we lost to PNG in the 2015. Qualifiers in Belfast and in Dublin. We lost to PNG because I was standing 50 yards from the PNG tent, and they did this song and dance after they had won. It was very entertaining, you know. And the PNG are a decent team. They are a decent team. It depends whether they all turn up in the day. It depends. To some extent, I've seen them a number of times, and it very much depends what side of bed they get out in the morning. You know, are they motivated or not? They're very mercurial, as I've seen in how they play. Some days they'd be a real high, other days, no. A couple of setbacks early on in the match, and they sort of get, and that's what they do. Sorry, that's what I've seen them do. Don't say they do it all the time, because they only see the occasion of the match. But I wouldn't, I wouldn't put a lot of money on Ireland coming out of that group. Theoretically, we should come out of it, but I wouldn't put a lot of money on coming out of it. I wouldn't, you know. Oman are a canny team. They're a tough little team. They fight, you know. They embarrassed us greatly in 2016, was it?
2016? Yep, 2016.
Oh, yeah, they really embarrassed us now, you know. That finished Max Sorensen's career.
I'll tell you what, Audrin, I think Oman's a much better team than they were in 2016.
You can see that from the work from the Division 2 of the World Cricket League. It's up there. In fact, they're ahead of Scotland, and Papua New Guinea are up there as well. I think I remember rightly. They're up there, aren't they?
No, Papua New Guinea is actually last in League 2. That may change. That may change, but yeah, you know, see, Audrin, I think the issue with Ireland, just to sum things up, of course, the over-reliance on Sterling and Balburnie, of course.
Yeah.
And just do you think the bigger issue in Irish cricket, and why perhaps it's not quite catching on, and you have a lot of kids perhaps choosing other sports over cricket, is simply because Ireland is not winning? Is that a reasonable assumption?
It would be part of the reason, Jay. Because the boom of the increase in people playing cricket, everybody else, came about as a result of Ireland winning matches in the World Cup 2007, 2011, and 2015. Now, it's interesting, the bounce from 2007, the bounce from 2011 were very noticeable. The bounce from 2015 was somewhat less noticeable. Now, why that is, I'm not 100% sure why that is. Because maybe there's a saturation point about the interest in Irish cricket. Because there is, as you say, I mean, there's GAA, there's soccer, there's rugby. You know, they're the main sports that would be, you know, people would play and follow. I mean, the numbers playing cricket, actually playing proper cricket, club cricket games every Saturday, Sunday, midweek, wherever, you know, would be relatively small now, relatively small. Compared to other sports, would be relatively small. And the nature of cricket is such that it's difficult to play another sport.
Yeah.
At the same time, you could get away with playing, as I did myself. You could play a soccer match for one team in the morning. You play somebody else in the afternoon. You know, but you can't really do it with cricket. You know, you're stuck with one sport, and it would be a great pity if all of that has been achieved in the last heading for two decades now was to start dripping away, slipping away. And as much as I would like to say that won't happen, I can't be certain that it won't happen. Because if we continue to lose games and quit, you see, the big, big blow for Ireland and for interest in it was we had qualified for the three previous 50-over World Cups. And the one that on our doorstep in England, we didn't qualify for.
Yeah.
And we should have done. We blew the qualifying tournament in Zimbabwe. We actually blew it. We had three shots at it. We lost to the West Indies, we lost to Afghanistan, and we lost to Zimbabwe. We only had to win one of those games. And there would have been a great number of people travelling from Ireland over to England to watch Ireland play. I mean, you can obviously tell that from the numbers that went to the ODI again in Lords in 2017, because I looked around the ground for the media box and it was actually packed. And then the test match. Yeah. I mean, 75%. I mean, Lords themselves, the MCC, were quite astonished at the number of people who bought a ticket for the Ireland game, because they thought it would do okay. But they were taken aback by the vast numbers that came for it. It was like, you know, it was looking around the ground, walking through John's Wood on the morning, first morning of the test match. It was incredible. It was Ari's accents everywhere. You know, and that was quite incredible. That was actually one of the more emotional I've ever had about Irish cricket, even more so at lunchtime when Tim Murdoch walked off holding the ball. I'm bowling at 85. You know, okay, we won't talk about the third day. you know, that never happened. The match was rained off. Did you know that? The match was abandoned after 2 days through rain. Did you not know that?
Yeah. That was just one of the craziest test matches ever.
My son lives in Australia. My oldest son lives in Australia. And I was going to say, I was up in literally in the center row of the media box looking at this. And he texts me, he said, just look at the score, because he enjoys cricket as well, played it. And he said, is this right? He says, England are 85, Ollie, not Ireland. I said, no, England are 85. Good God. he thought it was a mistake. He thought it was a misprint, you know, the wrong team name against it. And I say we beat England last year in ODI, you know, but again, that was down as we keep on coming. Back to starting Balbirnie, end up, you know. If either of those two got injured.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, who's going to come in their place? You know, sorry, there's another player I mentioned, maybe Camphor opening. There's a guy called Jeremy Lawler, who's Welsh, and he's been playing in the Interpros, and he's got an Irish passport. And the question has been asked directly of Barry Chambers, asked him, is he eligible to play for Ireland? Now, he believes he is. Now, he has batted quite well. Put it like this. He has batted much better than William Porterfield has in the Interpros. So if you use the Interpros as a criteria for getting into the Ireland team, then he is more deserving of it. Now, okay, you're back to Graham Ford saying, I need the experience. Well, actually, what you don't need is number three Balbirnie coming in the first over of the game.
Mm-hmm.
Under pressure. You know, Lawler actually, the Wolves took him out to Bangladesh early in the year. He didn't do that well now, in fairness. He didn't do that well. But he's made up for it since he came back, and he's batted well. And he can open. Now, he went in number three for the Northern Knights, but the way the Northern Knights opening was James McCollum, unfortunately for him. Lawler was in the first over or the second over almost every game, the vast majority of the games he played. So he played as an opener. And I would have given him a chance. I'd give him a shot at it, you know. I really would. Because, I mean, what's the point in playing him and picking him for Interpros if he does perform? What's the point if you don't pick him for the team, give him a shot at it, you know?
Yeah. And I guess this circles back to our point, the point you were making about alternatives to William Porterfield. And certainly there are options there. And once again, it's just this strange policy from the selectors. And it's hard to know exactly what's going through their head. With an eye on time, Audrin, I want to ask you a quick question. It's a little bit of trivia here. So Ireland have played 30 ODIs since the retirement of Ed Joyce. How many games out of those 30?
Sorry, you just froze there. Picture froze.
Okay, I'll do that again.
After 30, do that again, yeah.
Ireland have played 30 games since the retirement of Ed Joyce.
Yes.
In games where neither Sterling nor Balbirnie has scored 50, how many games has Ireland won out of 30?
I'd say in best, 2.
You're bang on. 2 out of 30. That's a win percentage of 6.7% when Balbirnie and Sterling don't.
Yeah.
So,
that would be it. Yeah.
I mean, that's just yet another statistic that sums up Ireland's over-reliance on Balbo and Sterling and Paul Sterling. But
absolutely.
Interestingly, actually got a piece coming out the day after this podcast, I believe, and it's just this statistical deep dive into the over-reliance on both of them. So, I mean, you know, I'd love to send that to you when it does come out.
Okay. Yeah, dude, please. Yeah.
But Audrin, you know what? Thank you so much for coming onto the podcast.
You're welcome.
To wrap things up. If people want to find you on social media, you know, how do they find you online? Feel free to plug your social media or online.
My Twitter handle is Audrin Fly.
Great. Well, once again, Audrin, thanks for coming on. And let's certainly keep in touch.
Yeah, absolutely.
One of these days, you know, we'll bump into each other at a press box as well when the planes start flying again and
Up. Good. Hopefully that happens before I'm totally retired.
Thank you for listening. A reminder that you can follow Audrin on Twitter at AudrinFly. You can find us on Twitter and Facebook at All Over Crick. That's Crick without the K-E-T. All Over Cricket is a multimedia publication featuring articles and podcasts from contributors spread across the world. We provide fans with original and engaging content that reflects the truly global and gender-inclusive sport that we believe cricket should be. If you like this podcast, please share it and tell your friends about All Over Cricket.